Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today from WILL AM 580 in Campbell Hall, campus of the University of Illinois. Love to have you call in today. The numbers, as you probably know, if you've been a regular listener, or maybe haven't noted if you are a regular listener or not, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Today we have, a really terrific show. And to put it in context, back in 1970, I read a book, which is probably one of the best books I've ever read. It dealt with a subject I love dearly, baseball. And it was written by our guest today, Jim Boughton. The book was called Ball Four, and it was probably the first inside look at Major League Baseball that had ever been written that really presented the human side of what actually took place in a dugout, in a locker room, and on a baseball team. And if you were a real baseball fan, if you really followed the sport closely, it was simply a book that you couldn't help but love. It was selected by the New York Public Library as one of the books of the century in its list of the 20th century's books, as I mentioned at the outset of the show. Jim Boughton then became a legend thereafter, simply on the basis of that book, and has gone on to have a phenomenal career following his baseball career. And it's worth noting that although the book Ball Four is about a pitcher struggling to make it in the major leagues as a reliever, earlier in his career, Jim Boughton had been a 20-game winner for the world champion New York Yankees in the early 1960s. Since then, in the 1970s, Jim Boughton's worked as a sportscaster. He's written more books. He acted in the movie The Long Goodbye, and he now lives in western Massachusetts, and that's the subject for much of today's program, where he has lived near Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and has worked very hard to try to save the oldest ballpark in the country from being destroyed and replaced. And he's written a new book about those efforts called Foul Ball, My Life in Hard Times Trying to Save an Old Ballpark. It is a terrific book. I've just been reading it myself for the past 2 weeks. And he's here to talk about that book and what he's been up to. Jim Boughton, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you, Bob. Nice to be here.
It's really an honor to have you on the show, Jim. I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule to come on to the program. Why don't we just talk a little bit, if we can, about what the book is about, Foul Ball, and what the struggle was about, what you've been doing the last few years, to give our listeners a chance to hear what you've been up to.
Well, I've been do motivational speaking and some writing, and I live in South Berkshire County, and about a half an hour north of me is a town called Pittsfield, former home of General Electric, a blue-collar town that's lost a lot of its population when GE abandoned the town in the 1980s. In any case, Pittsfield's claim to fame has been its baseball legacy. They've been the home of a professional minor league team since the early 1900s. And the games have been played at a wonderful old ballpark called Wacona Park. It's one of the last of the wooden baseball stadiums. Baseball has been played on that site since 1892. And the people love their beloved old ballpark. And then they were recently faced a few years ago with what I call America's most costly hostage crisis. And this is happening in cities all over the country. It's perpetrated by the owners of professional sports teams. And it goes like this. Build us a new stadium or you'll never see your team again. And so the local owner of the baseball team had an opportunity to move to a new stadium across the border in Troy, New York, and now historic old Wacona Park was going to be abandoned. The people that run the town, the newspaper, the Berkshire Eagle, the bank, Berkshire Bank, and the law firm, and General Electric, decided they wanted to replace the old stadium and build a brand new stadium in the center of town owned by on property owned by the Berkshire Eagle. It's about a mile away from Wacona Park. And this essentially would end Wacona Park. The town is $9 million in debt. Their finances are being overseen by a state oversight board. They'd never be able to keep this old stadium alive, and they would lose the historic ballpark. And the people, however, didn't want a new stadium. They had voted three different times to against the new stadium, and yet they weren't able to get rid of the idea. That's when my partner, Chippy Litzer, and I decided that we would come in and save the old ballpark. We'd invest money, our own money and that of investors. We would renovate the old ballpark, and what's more, we would buy a team in a local independent minor league baseball league and buy the team, sell stock to the people in town, and Pittsfield for the first time would have a locally owned baseball team in their own historic ballpark, and they wouldn't have to face these threats every few years.
We're talking to Jim Boughton today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're talking about Jim Boughton's struggle to save an old ballpark in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and how he went up against the powers that be in that community, specifically the media and the newspaper. And also, as he already has alluded to, how this relates to a common problem across the country, big-time sports owners shaking down the public sector in their communities to force the public to buy them or pay for expensive new stadiums instead of using public monies for other uses. And if you'd like to call in and talk to Jim Boughton, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Jim Boughton is the author of a new book, Foul Ball, My Life and Hard Times Trying to Save an Old Ballpark, which chronicles this campaign of the last few years. Foul Ball was self-published, I might add, which is quite striking considering your success as an author in the past, that you didn't have publishers lining up trying to publish your work. And we'll talk about that in a second. But first, let's get back and talk a little bit more about what happened in Pittsfield. Because, you know, on the surface, Jim, the way you explain it, you would think that here you come forward with your business partner and say, look, you know, instead of having the city of Pittsfield spend a fortune building a new stadium, we can save this historic landmark, something very special to the region, all with private money. And we will also produce a locally owned team, baseball team, that you would have, you know, everyone in the community say, this is wonderful. This is a gift from heaven. We don't have to spend public money on this anymore. Yet, as your book chronicles, that's exactly what didn't happen, at least among certain important sectors of the population.
Well, the people, before we came along, in the 2 years that this battle has been going on up there between whether to build a new stadium or save the old ballpark, people had voted three different times against the new stadium, and that was when they believed there was no alternative, and that you know, if they didn't have a new stadium, they were going to lose baseball. When we came along and showed the people that they could have baseball and a locally owned team in the historic ballpark, we had 95% of the people of Pittsfield on our side. So it no longer was 55-45 in favor of the old ballpark. It was now 95-5% in favor of our proposal. And in spite of that overwhelming public support for our plan, we were denied the ballpark by the hand-picked parks commissioners. The mayor hand-picked the parks commissioners, and they voted to give the old ballpark to our opponent in this particular battle, who was a fellow by the name of Jonathan Fleissig, who has been shopping around the area. He's from New York City. He's not even from the area. He's been shopping around the Northeast trying to get some community to build him a new stadium. He went to Springfield, Massachusetts. He went to Hartford, went to Westchester, couldn't get it done. And so they chose Fleissig, the powers that be, the bank, the law firm, the newspaper, and GE, I call them the Gang of Four, chose Fleissig and gave the old ballpark to him so that he could block us out from establishing a team there. And when a new stadium got built, then Fleissig's reward would be he would get to play in a new stadium.
Now, why would this Gang of Four, I mean, what's in it for them? Why would this Gang of Four go against the will of 95% of the population on one hand, and also what on the surface seems like a great deal for the people of Western Mass to have private money pay for this rather than have to use public monies to build a ballpark?
Sure. It was an unprecedented offer, really. I don't know of any other community that's gotten that kind of an offer from businessmen. We made them an offer they couldn't refuse, and they refused it. But we couldn't understand why. Why would they insist on spending $20 million on a stadium downtown when with no taxpayer money, we'd take care of all the baseball business, all the baseball fans and baseball at Wacona Park, and they could spend that $20 million on something else for the city, build an indoor arena, a concert hall, a civic center, anything. But no, they insisted on this baseball stadium, and I made a wild guess early on in the book when I was I decided to keep notes at one point, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But I made a wild guess that maybe this property might be polluted. You know, it used to be junkyards down there a long time ago. GE was dumping PCBs in junkyards all over Pittsfield since the 1930s. Maybe they were trying to cover up a toxic waste dump. And ironically, it turned out I was right. The property was polluted. The newspaper never told the people that the property they were trying to palm off on the city, or, quote, donate to the city, was in fact polluted. They never told the people about this. The first anybody knew of the pollution was when it was confirmed in my book, when it came out in galley form in May. It was the first time that this became public. In any case, I think that's probably why. I would guess that's why the Berkshire Eagle wanted to build a stadium there. And a stadium is a perfect cover for pollution, because stadium doesn't go down into the ground like almost any other building would. A stadium basically sits on slabs, and then you have the big outfield and a large field, so it can cover a multitude of subterranean sins.
And so the Berkshire Eagle was giving this land to the city to build the stadium. Is that?
Yeah. They were quote going to donate this property to the people of Pittsfield, they had put this parcel together, and there was a vote to establish a civic authority. That the civic authority would be the entity that would build and manage the baseball stadium. And the civic authority was sort of a quasi, private public body that would take the transfer of the property from the Berkshire Eagle, and then that civic authority would build and manage the stadium. And there was a vote; the citizens had a chance to vote on whether or not they wanted the civic authority. This was the third time they were voting for or against the new stadium, effectively, and. They voted against the civic authority, but the civic authority had language in it that said that if there was any pollution found on the property, just by any chance, then that responsibility for that cleanup would pass to the city of Pittsfield.
Mm-hmm.
So this was something that the Berkshire Eagle had never told the citizens of Pittsfield. And we were not able to really make our case to the city council. We never were able to get them to vote on this issue or to even debate with us, to discuss it. We were trying to get them to talk to us about it. At one point, a member of the city council told my partner and I that the city council could not consider our proposal for Pittsfield until they were released by Andy Mick. Now, Andy Mick is the president and publisher of the Berkshire Eagle. So they were released by Andy Mick. So we go to Andy Mick and we say, Andy, we've got a great proposal for the city here. And he said it wasn't his decision. He said we would have to talk to his boss in Denver, Colorado, who happened to be Dean Singleton, owner of Media News Group, the chain that owns the Berkshire Eagle. So here were the people of Pittsfield with their 100-year legacy of baseball, and the fortunes of the community are in the hands of a guy in Denver, Colorado. That's when I started. That's when I decided I better start taking notes.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Jim Boughton today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The number here is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We're talking about Jim Boughton's new book, Foul Ball, My Life in Hard Times, Trying to Save an Old Ballpark. And let's talk now about the media and the media coverage, because, as you said, you've got 95% support among the general public for this idea of the ballpark. Yet the local newspaper is sort of on the other side. It's among the 5% that oppose it. What sort of press coverage did you and your partner get as you tried to advocate the case for keeping this old ballpark?
Well, the first day we made our proposal public, we were attacked the next day in the newspaper as being lightweight, as not having the money, this is a bad idea, et cetera, et cetera. And so then we had to correct that misinformation. So we wrote letters to the editors, and we ended up having to go on the radio to make our case, flyers, faxes, just posters, and what we thought would be we would present our idea, and then it would sit there and be considered by the government, and we'd hear back from them. But we were attacked so heavily by the Berkshire Eagle with misinformation, lying about us, and spreading rumors that we were forced to to stay in the battle, and it became an everyday battle all summer long. We spent the entire summer of 2001, working, exchanging facts at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning, trying to counter editorials that were in the paper the next day. We would go online to see what the paper was going to say, and then we'd try to counter that somehow, and it became a sort of a running battle. Fortunately, Chip and I, you know, have our own businesses, so we were able to devote all this time. I remember saying to my wife, Paula, at one point, I said, who else but Chip and I could do a thing like this? And my wife said, single people, mostly.
what was the coverage of what you were doing by the other media that didn't have a material stake in the outcome? Like, were you getting better coverage? There's no other newspapers, right? So this is basically it for dailies.
Yeah, well, the Berkshire Eagle is the only daily paper. We did get fair coverage from the weekly paper, a paper called the Pittsfield Gazette, which ironically won the New England Newspaper Award for fair coverage of this issue. So the weekly paper won an award for fair coverage, but not the daily paper, the Berkshire Eagle. Mm-hmm. The other problem that we had is that the most powerful newspaper, the most powerful other media in the area is WAMC, which is a public radio station, part of the NPR newspaper.
Your radio network.
Radio network, exactly.
It's in Troy or Albany?
That's in Albany, New York.
How far is Albany from Pittsfield?
Albany is about an hour from Pittsfield.
Okay.
Yeah, just across the border.
Mm-hmm.
And but the head of WAMC, the NPR station, was had a regular column in the Berkshire Eagle, and also the editor of the Berkshire Eagle was a regular guest on WAMC. So there was a personal relationship there between the two people who ran those two entities. And so the radio never covered this story. They just never covered it. And when people read the book now who live in this area, they say, gee, we had no idea this was going on. Well, of course they had no idea, because the main access to the news was the daily newspaper and the local NPR station.
What sort of lessons does your experience, what sort of lessons have they taught you about media that you didn't know before 2001? I mean, what have you learned here?
Well, I mean, it was. It's bad enough to have a single newspaper in town, but when that newspaper also is involved in the economic outcome of something going on in the community, the conflict of interest is just too great. And it showed me that there needs to be to really have a democracy, you have to have more than one or two voices in town. Especially when they're involved, in the town's business, and that was clear to me. And there needs to be some sort of rules established, some watchdog committee. I remember one of the citizens in Pittsfield came to me and they said, "Isn't there some watchdog group that would protect us? Why can't we get a fair coverage of this story?" And I said, "Well, I don't know who's responsible for that. I don't know if that's the FCC's responsibility or whose responsibility is. But there was really no relief from this. There was no help for the community. And these people have been living with this problem for many, many years. In fact, when Foul Ball first came out, I was getting dozens of emails, and people were stopping me on the street, and they were saying, yes, somebody finally told our story. Thank you. I don't know what the remedy for that is.
Well, as you may well know, Dean Singleton, the owner of the Berkshire Eagle, is a major media owner in the United States. Has been one of the lobbyists leading the fight in Washington this year to eliminate what's called the cross-ownership rule, which prohibits papers like the Berkshire Eagle from owning local radio and television stations. And if that rule change goes through, and right now it's being debated in Congress, it means that papers like the Berkshire Eagle will be able to buy up one or two TV stations and 5, 6, 7 radio stations in Pittsfield as well. So if anything, the situation is going to go from bad to worse.
I can't imagine what would happen if the Berkshire Eagle, the same people also owned a local television station. I just can't imagine that, because what happens is that when you get a paper like the Berkshire Eagle, they're not beholden to the readership. They're really beholden to their advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
And that power, the power over the advertisers, would be even more consolidated with television.
We're talking to Jim Boughton today in Media Matters. Jim Boughton, the author of the new book, Foul Ball, My Life in Hard Times to Save an Old Ballpark. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in Media Matters. The phone lines are open if anyone would like to call in, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Jim, you know, I read Ball 4. I mean, I think I was one of the first people to read it when it came out. I think 1970, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And I was just 17 to date myself then. And I just absolutely adored the book. I was a big baseball fan, and also the stage of my life where the attitude you had was exact hit with me. And, you know, it's one of the most popular books that's been written on sports. I mean, I don't know how many copies it sold, but I imagine it's hundreds of thousands, if not millions.
Yeah.
And here you come along with this new book, and I've read it, most of it, and it's very well written. It's really engaging. It's a page-turner. I mean, it's not a thesis or something out of a philosophy department. And it's self-published. And I'm saying to myself, this is pretty crazy. Here's an author who's written one of the great books and has written other books, a well-known figure, has got a really readable book here. And why isn't it being published by a major commercial house? And why is this book self-published?
Well, that turned out to be part of the story. As a matter of fact, it's the last chapter in the book. I had signed a contract with a publisher called Public Affairs, and they were excited by this book. They liked the idea of it. They felt it was a national story, the issue of taxpayer-financed stadiums and small-town government, etc. And as a matter of fact, they were really enjoying the manuscript pages that I was sending them. And by the time I was finished with the book, they thought this was going to be their big book of the spring this year in 2003. Mm-hmm. They had already arranged for a 16-city book tour. I had recorded an audio tape. It was going to be the lead book in their catalog. They had high hopes for this book. And then just before they went to press with their book catalog, and this was last year, last fall, the publisher, Peter Osnos, the publisher of president of Public Affairs, sat down with me at lunch and told me that I would have to get balancing comments from General Electric for everything I was saying about them in the book. And I said, "Well, Peter, that's not necessary. They're only mentioned on about 10 or 15 pages. It's a backstory, and I didn't get balancing comments from Major League Baseball when I wrote Ball 4. I'm not going to get balancing comments from General Electric. Let them write their own book." Then he tells me that that a friend of his is the top lawyer at General Electric, and he's going to be owning a percentage of Public Affairs. He was going to become an investor in the publishing company. A week after that, the guy I was editing, working with, the editor at Public Affairs, told me I would have to remove all references to pollution and General Electric from the book. And I said, "Well, you can forget about that. I'm not doing that." Then I said, "I want my termination." They refused to give me a termination letter. You know, when you sign a contract with these publishers, they own the rights then until they let you go.
Yeah.
And they could hold on to it for a year or two, not even publish the book. So
basically they can kill it if they want.
They can kill the book. I said, "Okay, if you're not going to publish this book, I want a termination letter so I can go to another publisher." It took them 3 months to give me a termination letter. I finally had to hire a lawyer to threaten to sue them to get this termination letter, during which time, Bob, you'll be interested to know that the lawyer for the publisher told me that I could keep half of my advance if I promised not to say why I was leaving Public Affairs. I told my agent, I said, "I don't know what my price for silence is, but I know it's not $25,000.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, by the time I got my termination letter, it was too late for me to make a contract with another publisher and get the book out in June of this year, which is when I wanted it to be out, and so I had to publish it myself.
And how is that going? What is it like to self-publish a book? And remember, you're talking to an academic community where this is probably an option a lot of us are sometimes considering.
Well, I'll tell you, it's an expensive enterprise. I had to hire a book designer to design a cover and to design the type and the page layout and all of that. So you need a book designer. You need a publicist to get the word out that you're, you know, publishing this book. And then you have to find a significant amount of money to print the books. Then you got to find a distributor to distribute the books. So it's a lot of work. It really goes well beyond the scope of authors. Fortunately, I'd had some business experience in the past, and so I was able to use that to get me through this. And the book was able to be printed, and it is in stores, and was in stores by June 1st. So I made my deadline, but you know, had to borrow a lot of money. And
has it undermined your ability to get the publicity you thought you would get when you went to public affairs? You talked about doing a 16-week or 16-stop book tour.
I can't afford a 16-city book tour, that's for sure. So what I'm doing is I'm making appearances at college campuses, and speaking to journalism classes and also urban studies programs in exchange for travel expenses and a small honorarium. So in effect, I'm getting a book tour paid for in exchange for doing college lectures.
Does something like Amazon.com or some of the other internet booksellers, does that make it easier for you, that now that you don't have to worry as much about getting it physically into the bookstores?
Well, my distributor has done a pretty good job, Midpoint Trade Books, an independent distributor, and they've done a pretty good job of getting the book out there into stores. Fortunately, there were a lot of people who read Ball 4 who have heard about the book and have gone to the stores to buy it. I also sent out an email to anybody in the last 2 years who have had anything nice to say to me about Ball 4.
Mm-hmm.
So they became my mailing list for a sort of an email internet blitz. I said, I'm publishing my own book. Here's what it's about. If you like Ball 4, I think you'll like Foul Ball. Pass this along to anybody else who you think might want to read it. So I think that helped. We've also gotten some very good reviews from the San Diego Union, the San Francisco Chronicle, AOL Sports, etc. So the reviews have been excellent, and there are a lot of Ball 4 readers out there who are buying the book. So it's still out there. It's doing very well. The problem with a self-published book is that a lot of newspapers have policies against reviewing self-published books on the grounds, I think, that years ago, self-published books were basically vanity books.
You know,
a wealthy person would write a book about himself or have one written about himself, and then really wouldn't be a worthwhile book. It would just be sort of vanity press.
And then they'd buy off a reporter to write a review, probably.
Right, but now we have, I think, more legitimate reasons for authors to say, I'm going to have to publish this book myself because the system, you know, isn't working for me. And I think newspapers need to, who are not now reviewing self-published books, maybe need to rethink that policy.
We're talking to Jim Boughton today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. In the coming weeks on Media Matters, our guests will be next week, John Wilson, a local chap from Bloomington Normal, to talk about his work on media in Bloomington Normal and some of his writings on the coverage of the war, among other issues. 2 weeks from today, our guest will be Noam Chomsky, the noted linguist and political critic. In 3 weeks, we've got Peter Hart as our guest. Peter Hart has authored a new book called The O'Reilly Factor, a critique of Bill O'Reilly and The O'Reilly Factor. And then finally, 4 weeks from today, we'll have as a guest my dear friend John Nichols, the nation's Washington correspondent, talking about politics and anything under the sun. So stay in tune with Media Matters for the next few weeks. And thank you for listening to the show. We greatly appreciate it. Jim, what are the lessons that you learned from this experience in Pittsfield that apply across the country? So this is a story that just doesn't apply to Pittsfield, but it applies to Champaign-Urbana or Decatur, Illinois, or where you went to high school, Chicago.
Yeah, I went to high school on the south side of Chicago, Bloom Township High School.
Mm-hmm.
Lessons learned? I don't know if I've learned any lessons. I mean, it's clear to me that the system is not working. And that you can't have a democracy unless you really have a free press. And I mean a free, independent, adversarial press, a watchdog press, somebody looking out for the people's interest. If you don't have that, then the local people that run the government will just, they'll just do whatever they want. And because they don't need the voters. They've got the newspaper and the radio station. They've got the money behind them. They'd rather have a huge donation. They can buy the votes that they need from a handful of people who are running things behind the scenes. And so the only counter to that is an independent press. And I don't really know what the answer to that is. It was shocking for me to discover all this. My partner and I went up there with this idea for a stadium, and we just we were innocents, and I've been around. I've had some experiences. I never expected anything like this. It was shocking to see how the media behaved. I couldn't believe it.
Have you ever seen Michael Moore's film Roger and Me?
Yes.
You know, when you were describing Pittsfield in the book and then now on the program, it was reminiscent of the corruption and the decay.
Yeah.
To what was the case in Flint and I think the many cities across this country that have been deindustrialized.
Yeah. And you know what happens is that a lot of these communities, they have this power and structure entrenched in there, and it's the big boys, the Gang of Four, that run things in Pittsfield. But there are plenty of politicians happy to do their bidding. Because they retain control of things, and that's what they want to do. They don't want anybody from the outside coming in, no matter what they're bringing, no matter what kind of good offer they have for the community. They don't want to share power. These are like Afghan warlords. They'd rather rule over rubble than share power in paradise.
Yeah, that might be a more apt analogy than anyone would like to hear. We're talking to Jim Boughton today in Media Matters. The phone number, if you'd like to talk to Jim, the author of Foul Ball, and former 21-game winner for the 1963 Yankees. Jim, is that it?
Yep.
The number here is 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phones now. Philo, you're on the air with Jim Boughton.
Yes, this is an incredible story. It just amazes me. One quick comment about it is I thought that the conservatives in this country were interested in private enterprise. You were offering private enterprise, and they didn't seem to want it. But the other question I have for you is, for your book being published, do outlets like Borders and Barnes & Noble carry your book?
Yes, they do. I don't think the corruption has gone that far down into the system, because I know they are displaying the book and they're carrying the book, and so that's one good thing. But I tell you, I get very nervous when I see these conglomerates buying up these publishing chains, and the next step is one of them is going to buy a major book distributor, and we're going to have very, very few ways to get a book like this published.
Yeah. Yeah, that was basically my question, because, I mean, these huge, you walk into, at a place like Barnes & Noble, and you sometimes wonder, I mean, what do they not carry, because they don't like it, or whatever.
Exactly. You don't know. And, 90% of the books in a bookstore are published by about 5 publishing companies, believe it or not. You see hundreds of different imprints, but almost all of those imprints are under large corporate umbrellas, so that one corporate umbrella would be AOL, Time Warner. Another one would be Random House, and within those structures, Simon & Schuster. Within those structures, there'd be 15, 20 different imprints. So you think there's a lot of diversity out there, but there isn't. If somebody wanted to prevent a book from being published by a major publisher, they'd only need to make 5 phone calls.
Okay. Yeah, really. So the name of your book's Foul Ball.
Foul Ball's the name, and Jim Boughton's last name is Boughton.
And what year was that published, 2003?
Yeah, published this year. Just came out.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Yeah, Jim, and the first part of his question I thought was interesting, too, because traditionally we associate, at least rhetorically, a concern with private enterprise with political conservatives. And in the book, you make it quite clear that you're not a political conservative by U.S. standards. I mean, you were a McGovern delegate in 1972 and a more liberal Democrat, or at least liberal, say. And, was this anything to do with political philosophies, or is just basically corruption?
No, it didn't have anything to do with political philosophies, because my partner, Chippy Litzer, is an investment banker. We don't agree on anything politically. I mean, we're really great friends, but we went into this. I thought it was a great idea, and Chip thought that the business community couldn't possibly turn this idea down. He couldn't believe it. He doesn't know what to think.
Yeah. Okay. We're talking to Jim Boughton today on Media Matters. You know, around the country.
Just one more point, Bob.
Yeah, please do, Jim.
Yeah. This was not liberal and conservative. This was not a Republican and Democrat because the government was Democratic.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Democratic government. It had nothing to do with that. It had to do with power and not power.
Yeah. Yeah. In around the country, this story is replayed in different ways in city after city where sports owners, as you said at the very beginning of the show, basically say to communities, look, you build me a fancy new stadium or else I'm going to go to a town that will. And there are lots of towns that would like to have a sports franchise. And Pittsfield, of course, is minor league baseball. For years, it was a great double-A franchise in the Eastern League. And I think now it's moved on to A-ball and short season ball. But in major league cities around the country where the price tag is very high, we're talking about, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to build stadiums. Owners are shaking down communities for baseball and football stadiums.
Hundreds of millions, Bob, doesn't begin to touch it. $20
billion. $20
billion. Estimated $20 billion. And that's just what's visible over the last 20 years for sports arenas of one kind or another at the major league level.
And that's
major
public sector level. Spending. I mean,
public
taxpayers forking out that sort of money for ballparks.
Exactly right. Taxpayers. And that doesn't even include, you know, right-of-ways and land swaps and tax breaks and all sorts of other things that they get in addition to the cash that they get from the taxpayers at the expense of schools, hospitals, fire departments, you name it. It's massive corporate welfare. But here's what happens at the minor league level. That's just the major league. The minor league level, the last 20 years, 113 new minor league ballparks have been built. 113 new parks, all in the range of $20 to $25 million per stadium. All mostly at the expense of abandoning an old ballpark in town that the people are perfectly happy with. So that's 113, and these stadiums, Bob, are sold as bargains to the community. People go to these games and they say, "Boy, this is great! Hot dogs are only $2. Parking is free. It's like Joe Sixpack helping to buy a local movie theater so he can get a discount on the popcorn."
We're talking to Jim Boughton today in Media Matters. The phone number 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Urbana, you're on the air with Jim Boughton.
Hi, good afternoon. This is a great story. I was just thinking about a couple of things listening to this. One is the situation in Green Bay with the Packers, how the community actually owns that stadium. I'm not a football fan, but I read this article in Mother Jones about the situation.
Well, actually, they own the team, I think, too, which is really the more important part of it.
Right, exactly. And how that couldn't happen in a community like that, and that sort of thing is, you know, that sort of situation is on the way out. But the other thing, I was just thinking that this is just a classically American story about a community banding together. And this is just the kind of thing you might expect to hear, you know, trumpeted, you know, in any news media. And the fact that it's not just sort of a sad statement of where things are. But anyway, it was a great story. Thanks for digging it up.
Thank you. Well, one point about the Green Bay Packers. Yes, it's true that the Green Bay Packer community owns that team, and that's why nobody has ever threatened to pull the team out of town unless they got a new stadium. And it's precisely that reason that professional sports now prevents communities from owning teams.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that point.
They've got rules now so nobody can do that because they want to. If too many communities own teams, then the rest of the teams can't bid one city off against another.
Yeah, and I don't want to, you know, I mean, it just seems, if you think about it, what exactly do the owners of these teams contribute to the, you know, the process that's valuable other than sort of being, you know, like shaking down communities? I mean, they don't play the game. They hire people to do the scouting and coaching. Yet, you know, as the Green Bay Packers prove, maybe you can have a successful franchise without having some rich guy on the team.
The argument that's made for new stadiums, that the new, and this is a common argument made all over the country, is that new stadiums have a positive economic impact on the community. And yet, every single study that's ever been done by any independent economist shows that that is not true. First of all, even if restaurants crop up around the new stadium, which sometimes happens, all that does is cannibalize restaurant business from other parts of the town. As far as jobs, the only jobs that a new stadium brings to the local community are ticket taker, groundskeeper, and you know, mascot, whatever, running around with his funny suit on. The real money made with a sports team is made by the owners and the players, and they take that money home with them at the end of the season. You know, the thing that people don't understand is they read the newspapers and they see somebody's making $20 million, this player's making $10 million, $15 million, and what people don't realize is that the taxpayers are subsidizing those salaries. People who don't even like baseball, don't even go to ball games, their tax dollars are subsidizing those salaries, because team owners, when they don't have to build their own ballparks, their own plants, like any other business, are allowed to make enormous profits, which they're now forced to share with the players because the players' unions are so strong. But it's the taxpayers that are financing not just the stadiums, but indirectly players' salaries.
Now, Jim, let me play the devil's advocate for a second. You know, it's one thing to talk about a place like Pittsfield, where you've got a beautiful old ballpark that's going to be replaced by some new one that's going to cost a fortune, when you could keep this charming old park together and this historical landmark. But what about, you know, in a city like Seattle, Washington, where you have, you know, an abysmal mausoleum called the Kingdom, or many other cities like Pittsburgh or Cincinnati, where you have these horrendous multi-purpose stadiums that were built in the late 60s and early 70s, and those get torn down and get replaced by these, you know, incredibly charming new ballparks. They might cost a lot of money, but they'll be around for 50 or 100 years, and you love baseball. I mean, they're a pleasure to watch baseball in by comparison to the parks they replaced.
Well, the Kingdome was sold to the community as the ultimate baseball stadium. They'd never have to replace the stadium because it was you know, a modern facility about you know, no longer than, you know, 25 years ago. I forget when the Kingdome was built, but it soon becomes outdated, and now they need a new ballpark. The new ballparks, 20 years from now, somebody's going to be coming forward and say, well, it's a new ballpark, but now it needs this. Now it needs some feature. Now it needs a roof over it. It needs this. It needs that. Or it needs to be designed by Frank Gehry. It needs to be a Liebsgeind stadium. We can't draw enough people unless it's a, you know, it's one thing after another. Some of these communities like Minnesota, they're not even done paying off the last new stadium.
Yeah, they're on to their new one already, too. So it's really, these things turn over, it seems like, in a two-decade process or three decades at the outside.
Yeah, but they don't pay for themselves. That's the thing. I mean, if the taxpayers were getting a good value for their money, and it was better to really have people go to a ballpark than to improve their schools, then maybe that argument would make some sense. But the people don't want these stadiums and consistently vote against them, and the government does everything it can possibly do to keep these issues off the ballot. So the stadiums usually get approved by some, you know, obscure county, you know, commission or something like that. In New York, for example, the outgoing Mayor Giuliani had on the drawing board two new baseball stadiums, one for the Yankees, one for the Mets, at a total cost of $1.6 billion. And if it hadn't been for 9/11, those two stadiums would have been built. Just as Mayor Giuliani built two minor league baseball stadiums for the Mets and the Yankees, one in Staten Island and one in Brooklyn, at the cost of millions of dollars. The people never got a chance to vote on it. And when Mayor Giuliani was asked why shouldn't the citizens of New York City be allowed to vote on how their taxpayers' dollars are spent, he said because they would vote against it.
You know, in your case of in the Berkshires in Pittsfield, it was obvious why the daily newspaper owned by the Singleton Media conglomerate was opposed to what you were doing, because they had a stake in the outcome, a financial stake. In other cities, are media more balanced from your experience in covering these issues because they don't necessarily have an immediate stake in it?
No. There's a common denominator in most of these stadium battles, and I've come to learn about a lot of them because when the book came out, I suddenly started getting letters from all over the country and people in different towns. We have the same problem in this town. Oh, your book reads just exactly like what happened here. There seems to be some common denominators, one of them which is that the local newspaper is behind the new stadium. Almost always, in almost every case, the local paper backs the new stadium because they're usually tied into the major business and advertisers in the town, and those are the guys that want the new stadium because it's, in many cases, it's going to improve the real estate value of the businesses that they already own, etc.
And they're not paying for it.
And they're not paying for it. So the local newspaper in favor of the new stadium is part of it. The other common denominator is every effort possible is made to keep it off the ballot. The other common denominator is that the financing schemes are always complicated. They're using some state funds, they're using a grant, they're using bonds, they're using foundation money, and it's very, very complicated. What's not complicated is that in no instance does the local team owner or league contribute significant dollars to the building of these stadiums. That's the only thing. That's the only thing that you can count on.
But the complexity makes it so that people can't really pin it down either. So
yeah, it's hard. What they do is they make it as complicated as possible so that they can play hide the subsidy.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Jim Boughton today on Media Matters. We've got about 8 or 9 minutes left if you'd like to call in. The number 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Jim Boughton is the author of the new book, just came out this summer, Foul Ball, My Life in Hard Times, Trying to Save an Old Ballpark, available online or at fine stores. It's a self-published book for reasons Jim has explained on the show today. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Terre Haute, you're on the air with Jim Boughton.
Hello. I was wondering if you didn't have any threats from GE about lawsuits or rumors of threats, or how was that handled?
No, I haven't been threatened with any lawsuits. It may be because I would write about it, and just as I did the story with the publisher and why I couldn't get the book published, I wrote about that in the book. The book is well documented. I have contemporaneous notes. I took notes every single day. I have two big cardboard boxes of detailed notes, just as I did with Ball 4. There are 40 pages of documents in the back of the book supporting what I'm saying in Foul Ball.
Yeah, I can say if you've read Ball 4 and liked it, and I assume a lot of the listeners have, it is very much a similar style, documented with dialogue. It's a readable book. All right, caller, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
I was wondering, you didn't, with the other, all these 113 other ballparks, they weren't all toxic waste dumps. So.
No. There's a different reason in every city for building these stadiums. It just happened to be in Pittsfield. I think that was one of the reasons why they wanted to build this stadium on this particular site. But there are plenty of other reasons for building stadiums, depending on the community. So it's not always for the same reason. But the commonalities I talked about had to do with the newspaper involvement, the attempts to keep it off the ballot, and the complicated financing. But each town is unique in its own reasons for why a ballpark has to be built in town, a new ballpark.
Well, it's very interesting. I'm looking forward to reading it.
Okay, well, thank you for calling. Jim, I think we ought to clarify exactly where matters stand right now, because I think we've talked about the setup, but we haven't really gotten to the conclusion yet. What's the baseball situation in Pittsfield and the baseball stadium situation in Pittsfield, Massachusetts today?
Well, when the Parks Commission gave the ballpark to our opponent, Jonathan Fleissig, at the end of in October of 2001, it was a 2-year lease that they gave him. He's already spent his 2 seasons there, last summer and this summer.
He's had a team in there?
He's got a team in there. They played. They didn't do well. They finished last, and they finished last in attendance both years, partly because he never really won the people over. They all wanted our proposal, and they were angry that they didn't get what they wanted with their community-owned baseball team. And so the guy that did get the ballpark, he didn't really earn it, and the people understand that. And so he didn't get the attendance he needs. And right now he's negotiating with the city and dictating to them the terms under which he will return if they want him back.
Could you intervene at this point, since the lease is up, and you and your partner make a counteroffer similar to what you've done before?
Or yeah.
Are you thinking about doing that?
No, we're not at all. We could go back, but we wouldn't have the support of the people that run that community. A minor league baseball couldn't possibly succeed if it had as its chief opponent the local newspaper.
Yeah.
There is no local newspaper in the country that doesn't root for the home team, especially in the smaller towns. So,
what about the new ballpark idea? What's happening with that?
Well, that's in limbo right now, and nobody's talking about a new stadium these days with the massive state deficits now, and budget deficits and the money crunch and what's happened to the economy. So I don't think anybody's going to come forward and propose a new stadium, certainly not in Pittsfield for a long time. So Pittsfield may be without a baseball team if this guy that they gave the ballpark to decides he doesn't want to keep playing there. It's exactly the situation my partner and I brought our proposal forward with in order to prevent, which is to have the team owner now calling the shots and telling the city what they're going to have to do to keep them.
Now, when you on the book jacket and inside, you've got drawings of what the ballpark would look like after you'd put a significant investment into sort of refurbishing it.
Yeah.
Has this new owner the person currently running the ballpark, has he put any money into fixing the stadium up?
No, hardly any. He did a quick spray paint of the exterior of the stadium. That was it. We had pledged to put $250,000 in by opening day, and an average of $1 million a year in upgrades over a 10-year period. And keep in mind that the town would still own the ballpark. We weren't asking to buy this thing. We were going to put private dollars in there. We just needed a long-term lease so that we would have a time frame in which to earn back our investment. We calculated that we would need to almost double the attendance that has been historically at the ballpark in order for us to recoup our investment. But we felt we could do that because we were going to market Wacona Park as an historic site and market it as a national must-see, one of those stadiums that you need to visit when you come to the Northeast and you're going to go to Yankee Stadium and Fenway Park and Cooperstown. You need to go to Wacona Park also. So it was going to be one of the stops along the stadium tour that many of these baseball fans are making around the country. So we were going to do a national marketing, and we felt that, after maybe 3 or 4 years, we might even make some money on it. But it was mostly we were going to do it for the fun of it.
So what do you, now that you're not going to become a ballpark entrepreneur or team owner, it looks like, what's next in Jim Boughton's future?
I have no idea. You know, I've never had a plan for my life, and I'm 64. I still don't have a plan, so I'm not worried about it. Something will come along. Right now, I'm just promoting the book. I want to, see that it has the widest audience possible. I'll be doing an update to the book. It'll be out in paperback next year about this time, so I'm focusing on that right now.
And also we should add that there is an update you've done with a big epilogue to Ball 4, the original American classic, so people can get that. If you've read the original, you might want to get the updated version. Is that right?
Yeah, the original book was Ball 4, and then I did an update in 1980, another one in 1990, and then a third one in 2000, and that book is called Ball 4, The Final Pitch. It's available in hardcover only. It's the original book plus all the updates, plus 124 player photos and an index and everything. So it's you buy Ball 4, The Final Pitch, you've got the whole thing.
All right. Well, you know, I hear the band tuning up in the background, Jim, which means it's time for me to clear out of the studio. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Media Matters. It's been terrific. Jim Boughton is the author of Foul Ball, My Life in Hard Times, Trying to Save an Old Ballpark. We've been talking about his struggles to keep one of the great ballparks in America alive, going up against the local newspaper monopoly, the Singleton firm, which is gobbling up as much of this country's newspaper as it can get its hands on as we speak. Jim, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
And I'll see you all 1 week from today.
Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye.